Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the press conference of the Cycling Podcast on the Tour de France. Questions in French and English only, questions en français et en anglais uniquement. No questions will be taken on the Anglo-French relationship.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney, laughing Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Francois Tomazo.
Hi there.
We're convening, chaps, on Saturday morning before the time trial stage of the Tour de France that will settle this year's tour, to record our third press conference where we listen to your questions that you've phoned in and try to answer them as best we can. So let's just crack on with that, shall we? Let's have the first question.
Dear Richard, Lionel, Daniel, greetings from India. My name is Sandeep Krishna and I'm a long-time listener of the podcast. Really enjoy your cycling insights, but a bigger fan of your non-cycling banter, really. I have a question about Chris Froome. How do you comment on Froome, who is capable of winning or at least featuring in GC of consecutive Grand Tours, when an average pro, he gets completely run down even completing one? Is it that he's physiologically a freak of nature? Or are Team Sky masters in managing his and their team's efforts within the tours? I find it extremely contrasting when we hear from other pros talk of how hard it is to make the time cut every day for the 21 days. Thanks a lot for your regular podcasts and keep the banter going and the wine flowing. Cheers, guys.
Well, thank you, Sandeep, for your question. That's the first call we've ever had from India, so it's great to know that people are listening there.
Is talking about Chris Froome, does that count as non-cycling related banter?
Oh, goodness. Well, Sandeep phoned in his question before the race hit the Pyrenees and the race sort of ran away with Chris Froome. As we speak, Froome is fourth. He's not going to win his fourth Grand Tour in a row, but the question is still valid. When some riders, talk about the toll that a Grand Tour takes on them, and, you know, in particular, we've been talking a lot about trying to double up with the Giro and the Tour. The question is certainly valid. Tom Dumoulin, of course, second at the Giro and certainly still in contention here at the Tour. But there's quite a lot of riders here who have ridden the Giro and the Tour, an unusual number this year. Quite a few of the key domestiques. I mean, Wout Poels at Team Sky, Chad Haga at Team Sunweb. I think more than normal, and I think partly that's because there was an extra week's recovery between the two races. But also another factor, I think, I was looking just at the race days that all these guys have done. Froome didn't race very much at all before the Giro, neither did Tom Dumoulin. And if you compare their race days with a lot of the other riders who are having to ride a much fuller program, they've raced fewer days than a lot of the lesser riders.
Yeah, I also think that the guys that are at the top of the GC are the real outliers in the sport, aren't they? They are, by definition, physical freaks. They are the best of the best. But that just because the riders in the Gruppetto in the mountain stages are working extremely hard to make the time cut, the margins are pretty small. 35 to 45 minutes over, 150 to 200 kilometres. These are small margins, and that is how the sport operates. The riders at the top are the absolute best, but the guys who are just about making it in are still, you know, world-class athletes. And I think we saw from the stage that was the Étape du Tour for the amateurs, Mark Cavendish was eliminated, or was it the day before? No, it's the Le Grand Bornand stage, I think. On whichever day the attack was, the guys in the Gruppetto were in quicker than the winner of the attack. So that kind of puts into context how good these riders are.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, it's Bleck from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that cycling is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. For me, it gives me the headspace to think about the people dearest to me and focus on the most important things in life. It's amazing where your mind goes when you give it time to wonder. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world with 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. Head to rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Thank you to Rafa, whose title sponsorship of the cycling podcast has allowed us to travel around France and report on the Tour de France in the way that we have. Again, thank you very much indeed to them. Let's have another question, shall we?
Hello chaps, I'm Holly from East London. My question is about the benefits of drafting behind teammates. I can understand the benefit of riding behind domestiques on the flat, where you have to ride in the wind for a long time, but I don't get it in the mountains. It's obviously useful to have someone around you to lend a wheel if you puncture, but going at that slow pace up a mountain surely doesn't provide much in the way of wind resistance. So what's the benefit? Is it mainly psychological? Many thanks and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Holly. That really is an excellent question. And, you know, there was a study at the start of this tour that was released, some Dutch academics, well, led by a Belgian academic, who really produced some hard data on the benefits of riding in the middle of the peloton on a flat stage. Clearly, the benefits on the flat, where the wind is the greatest resistance, are well known. In the mountains, where it becomes gravity is the real issue, they're less significant, but they are still a factor. And I think part of it is psychological, the kind of support. It's part of it's also just controlling the pace. And when you've got, you know, four, five strong Team Sky riders controlling the pace on a climb, it puts other riders off attacking, because those guys are going to be able to get them back by just riding at a consistent pace. I mean, one of the first times I ever really saw this in action was in the 2012 Tour, when Cadel Evans attacked from like 55 kilometers to go. It was actually the La Tussure stage, and the Team Sky train at the front of on the climb, I think it was the Glandon, didn't flinch at all, didn't react in any way, because they were riding to watts. They were looking at how many watts they were producing. Michael Rogers was the road captain at the time, and he knew that if they just kept riding to sort of 410 watts or whatever it was they were doing, they would eventually get Evans back, and they did. So it's about controlling the pace, knowing what you're capable of on a certain climb over a certain stage, and that's where I think the idea of this sort of mountain train comes from.
Yeah, my impression is, as you say, it's more a matter of watts than a matter of slipstream in the case of the mountains, and it actually it's a kind of a tradition that was established before the power meters, when you had very experienced riders. I remember Gérard Rouet working for Banesto, or this type of guys. They knew before the power meters what kind of a pace they could impose to the peloton to make sure their leader was not in trouble, and to make sure as well that the others were in trouble. So it's more a matter of pacing and not overdo it, because otherwise you're in trouble, than a matter of... But the slipstream effect obviously also works. I mean, there are lots of calculations about watts on the mountains made by, you know, diverse and more or less serious people. It's a very, very complicated problem. Nobody really knows how it works. But the simple fact that we see... Even yesterday, even in the last stage in the mountains, we saw in the Tour de France when Chris Froome was in trouble and Egan Bernal waited for him. What was the point? You know, was it psychological? Was it important in terms of the slipstream? My impression is it's both, because sometimes in the mountain we don't see it, but winds are really important, you know, important factors. I mean, the wind doesn't cease to blow because you go up in the mountain. It does blow, and if it blows, if it's headwind, it's even worse in the mountain than it is on the flat. So never underestimate that aspect of things. So I think it's a little bit of both, but I agree with you. Richard, it's more a matter of watts and pacing than a matter of wind.
It's kind of similar to running. You know, in running, in long distance running, you talk about pace making rather than slipstreaming, but it's a bit of both there as well.
Of course,
at, you know, the pace, the speed at which they run, the slipstreaming effects are less, but they're still there. And it's the same in the mountains on a climb when they're riding at, you know, 11, 12, 15, 16 miles an hour, kilometers an hour. The faster you go, the more significant the slipstreaming effects are, of course.
Yeah, but the margins are so much finer in the mountains. So although the speeds are slower, the overall effect of the slipstreaming may be less because of, you know, they're climbing the hill. Those margins are finer. And so in a sort of paradoxical way, it become even more important. You know, if there wasn't a benefit, then Team Sky and others wouldn't attempt to, you know, offer the pacing and slipstreaming benefit to their team leaders. There obviously is. And I mean, I just remember from my own, if you're talking about how slowly you can ride up a mountain and whether or not there's any benefit, I remember climbing up the Tourmalet and a cycling club from Dax, there was about six or eight of them, came past me, not so fast that I couldn't just get on the back, and for maybe 4 or 5 kilometers I just sat there actually quite happily. Unfortunately they then peeled off to take photos and stuff, and I carried on trying to sort of maintain the same pace on my own, and absolutely blew my doors blew off, and I had to take a bit of a sit down at La Mongie.
chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's. Richard, you've been shaving with your Harry's razor for a few months now, and all our listeners can get started with Harry's today by claiming a trial set that's worth £11.50 for just £3.95, which is the cost of the delivery to your door. You'll get a Harry's razor, 5-blade German engineered cartridge, foaming shave gel and travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling. Rich, are you still enjoying using your Harry's razor?
Yes, indeed, Lionel. I've been happily shaving with my Harry's razor for several months now. I'm the willing guinea pig on the cycling podcast team. You and Daniel, not really that familiar with razors these days. But yeah, I took it away to the Tour de France, lent it to Francois, as documented previously on the podcast. I was worried I wasn't going to get it back from him, but I did. And I'm still happily using my Harry's razor. It's an excellent razor, and I would highly recommend it to our listeners if they want to give it a go.
So if you'd like to get your trial set for just £3.95, go to harrys.com/cycling. That's Harry's, harrys.com/cycling.
Hello chaps, my name is Jan and I'm from Prague, the Czech Republic. Much has been made of the hatred directed at Team Sky for its dominance, but it's not even close to the most successful team in the peloton. With 51 wins and counting and more Grand Tour stage wins than any other team, how does Quickstep avoid the ire that is so virulently directed at Team Sky? It can't be just the Froome case, because all of Sky's riders are catching heat. Why is Alaphilippe feted while Thomas is booed? Thanks, I'll hang up and listen.
Well, that's an excellent question as well. Quickstep, you know, their success on all fronts has been remarkable. And I remember when we were in the middle of their incredible classics campaign, we and Daniel especially talked about how they would fare when it came to the Grand Tours, and that they might, you know, really struggle because the lineup has changed a lot this year. They lost someone like Dan Martin, for example, who'd have given them a real presence in the Grand Tours. But the Giro and the Tour, they have had fantastic Grand Tours as well. I mean, Viviani at the Giro with stage wins and points classification. And here at the Tour, Julian Alaphilippe has been one of the stars of the race. So they've not been contesting for the overall wins in these races, but they have been incredibly successful as well. And yet, they're a popular team. They don't get that reaction that Team Sky get.
I tell you what, in my opinion, I remember the days. Quickstep has been around forever. I mean, they were Mappe. I've known Patrick Lefebvre in the sport for 30 years. And I can tell you in the days of Mappe, when they were always winning Paris-Roubaix every year with, you know, team tactics, they were very questionable at the time with Bortolami and guys like this. I can tell you they were really hated in the bunch, and they were hated by the Belgian, well, sometimes the Belgian public even. But it's been a long time ago. Now they belong to the, almost to the, you know, to the tradition of cycling. They've always been around. around, and so we know where they come from. Their company culture is known and accepted. The difference with Team Sky, they came from nowhere, saying they would win everything and win the Tour de France within 5 years, and coming from nowhere, all of a sudden they do that, and it looks, you know, well, and lots of course people are skeptical about it. I'll make an analogy from Team Sky. In 2008, I was at the Beijing Olympics. You were there, Richard, and Julien Preto, the Reuters correspondent, who's in the car with us today, was there as well, and there was a kind of incomprehension from the rivals of the British cycling team about how the British were doing it, because off, you know, in between Olympics, the French, for instance, were winning all the world titles in sprints, and on the day of the Olympics they got absolutely crushed, and there was a kind of, you know, disbelief of what was happening. They couldn't understand it. And the fact that this dominance coming from nowhere is to them unexplainable. We know why Quickstep win. They've always done it. Paris-Roubaix, the Tour of Flanders, they won scores of these races. So it's kind of accepted. But that all of a sudden someone comes and says, we're going to win the Tour, and they do it, and they do it every year. Of course, it creates skepticism, and in the same time, it creates hatred. I think that's the problem.
Dominance is nothing new, though, is it? I think that, you know, Molteni with Eddie Merckx used to absolutely dominate. Merckx used to win everything. His teammates used to pick up stage wins as well. In the 80s, well, we know about Lavie-Claire, Eno and LeMond. Well, LeMond and Eno were first and second in 1986, and then they had Andy Hampstead in fourth. I mean, if Team Sky had a third rider in the top five, I think the internet would probably go pop, wouldn't it? It's different times, of course. On the one hand, you can say that there's far greater strength in depth in the peloton, but I also think that there's such a concentration of talent in Team Sky and also in Quickstep. But Quickstep are very specific in their goals, just as Team Sky are. Quickstep aren't trying to win the Tour de France. Bob Jungels is just outside the top 10. You know, I think the interesting question would be, if Quickstep or another team were dominating the Grand Tours the way Team Sky has done, what would the reaction be then? And, well, we may not actually
find out. I think I know the answer to that, because I'll do another analogy with football. We kind of accept that Real Madrid win the Champions League every year because they've been doing this since the 1950s. If Paris Saint-Germain won the Champions League four or five times in succession, which might happen in the future, there'll be lots of hatred and skepticism, and people would say, they kind of bought it because they did it only with money. That's the problem. Team Sky come from nowhere. Quickstep, you know, have a tradition going back almost as far as Real Madrid have in football. I think that's where the problem comes from. I can tell you Paris Saint-Germain are hated in France by most people.
I think you're absolutely right, Francois. There is still a sense that Team Sky are sort of outsiders as well, and Dave Brailsford in particular. You know, there is in cycling the cultural fabric, you know, that Quickstep are part of, that Patrick Lefebvre is part of. And, you know, from the moment Dave Brailsford turned up in 2010, with having not been a professional rider himself, having never had any involvement in continental pro cycling, he was an outsider. And he felt that very keenly. Which I think has given him the desire, the drive to not just win but dominate in the way that they have. But there is that kind of, they have that outsider, and everybody involved in the team, pretty much the key people, you know, Tim Kerrison, Rod Ellingworth, none of them come from the tradition of continental professional cycling. So they are outsiders. They're not part of the fabric. And I think their talisman, Chris Froome, is not a rider who has captured cycling fans' imagination for, and I think it boils down in some respects to aesthetics. He doesn't look like a Tour winner should look on the bike. You know, I think when we think of the great champions, we sort of admire their talent and appreciate the beauty of what they look like on a bike, you know, and there's certain riders who fit that mold. I mean, Tom Dumoulin, you see him on a bike and it's poetry, isn't it? he fits them more. And I think as a result of that, there'll be fewer questions about Dumoulin's success.
Yeah, Bradley Wiggins got away with it because he was the son of a professional rider, even though he was not a road rider, and he's also himself kind of a fetishist of the history of cycling. So he fitted very well into this world of tradition, whereas Chris Froome doesn't.
I think that's a really interesting and important point, because Chris Froome really didn't understand or have a sort of deep knowledge of professional cycling. I was reading this morning some comments from Geraint Thomas from his book, actually, saying that in 2013, Froome said, "Oh, who's that Astana guy?" It was at the Tour of Oman, I think. "Who's that Astana guy? He's fast." And Thomas said, "Well, that's Vincenzo Nibali." You know, it doesn't feel like Chris Froome is, he wasn't brought up in the heartlands of the sport. Just on the sort of Quickstep Sky thing, lastly, I mean, and this opens up another level of discussion about the kind of the hypocrisy and blind spots that I guess we all have, the media, the fans, we're all guilty of it in some way. You know, Quickstep, and it struck me talking to Patrick Lefebvre this week about Sylvain Chavanel. I mean, let's not forget, Lefebvre and Quickstep signed Richard Virenque after his doping ban or his suspension after his confession. And Virenque is still cheered, and everyone waves at him, and everyone wants a photograph when he's here on the tour. So it's kind of strange, really, but that's just human nature, I guess. People have their favourites. People are willing to overlook certain things and think, well, bygones are bygones. And when it comes to others, they're not so willing to overlook.
But it's not just any kind of suspicion around Team Sky that makes them unpopular. It's the way they ride. And I think this question has become very pertinent one this week as they home in on a winning the tour with a third rider. And the Team Sky era began in 2012. The 2011 tour won by Cadel Evans seems like a long, long time ago, and that gives you a sense of just how long this dominance has now lasted. And the way that Team Sky ride, the way that they suffocate the race, the way that they ride at the front in the mountains and put others off attacking, it's not a great spectacle, and it doesn't lead to necessarily exciting racing. You know, we saw a fantastic stage at the Giro when Froome attacked when he had to, and when the circumstances were very different. That's kind of what we want to see. But with the strength and numbers that Sky have in these mountain stages, we don't get that, and so there's a bit of a crisis, in the Tour de France about how to make it exciting again when one team has such a stranglehold on the race.
I understand that you know, the Team Sky fans not understanding why their team are hated, but I'll go on with the football analogy. Who likes the Germans to win in football, you know? And it's unfair. They're
The Germans?
Yeah, Germany are everybody's favorite, most hated team outside of Germany. Why is that? Well, I don't know. Maybe that's the white jersey or something.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you, Science in Sport, for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Next question, please.
Hello, dear Cycling Podcast. My name is Cesar. I'm Colombian. I love your podcast. I've been a friend of the podcast since 2015. And I really love what you do. And I'm really appreciative of you guys taking the time of, traveling to these races and being away from your families and doing what you do. So thank you. I do wish you would talk more about the Colombians and bring more color to them. But I understand that there are limits to what you can do on that side. And I do appreciate your work, and I appreciate when you talk about everyone, including the Colombians. My question for you guys, or my thought, which I would love you guys to discuss, is the following. One of the things I love about cycling is not only how beautiful it is, but how diverse it is, where you have different type of people winning. And I think that's what makes cycling wonderful. But the way that the races are run now, I would submit to you there's only one body type that wins, which is the one that Froome and Dumoulin have, which is this big, stocky, strong body type that can win in flat, in time trials, and in the mountains. And I wish I weren't like that. I wish that smaller body types like the Yates brothers or like Quintana would have a chance. And I think the way the routes is set out today for the Grand Tours, it doesn't, because you have these, you know, beautiful, amazing, chaotic flat stages, but then the smaller guys usually lose out. Then you have the mountains, which, you know, maybe the smaller guys can win by a bit. But then you have the time trials and then lose out again. And so it's going to end up being that, you know, all the races are won by these stocky types. And I wish it weren't the case. It's not the, certainly not the case in soccer. And I wish it just wasn't the case here. I hope that diversity wins and not just one body type. That's what I would love you to discuss. I know I'm late, so maybe I won't have time. You guys won't have time to hear this. But I just love what you guys do. Keep at it. Un abrazo, César.
Thanks, Cesar. That was, well, interesting points in there. I mean, one of the things I've always loved about cycling is the diversity in the body shapes. And you see it now at the Tour de France. You've got, you know, Peter Sagan, who almost looks like a rugby player. Or, you know, he's very muscular, big. And someone like Nairo Quintana, who's very small. And there have been races where you've got, you know, 6'5" Conor Dunn, or 6'8" Conor Dunn, sorry, and Esteban Chavez, and it's amazing that these two riders can compete in the same event. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the increasing specialization of within the sport, where the climbers are getting skinnier, the sprinters are getting more muscular, and how these different body types will be accommodated and able to, you know, finish a Grand Tour in the case of the sprinters. But in all sports, body shapes are changing and becoming more extreme. You know, there's a fascinating book by David Epstein, the Sports Gene, which there's a chapter in there called the Big Bang of Body Types, and he talks about, you know, in a lot of sports, basketball players are getting ever taller, gymnasts are getting ever smaller. And if you go to, say, the opening ceremony of Olympic Games, you can almost tell, whereas 30, 40 years ago, the athletes would just look athletic. Now, they're more extremes. You can see, you can sort of identify who does what sport by their body shape. And certainly that is happening in cycling too. I don't know what the answer to it is. I mean, I don't, you know, in this tour in particular, we've got a situation where the four top guys are all, they're all kind of strong climbers, but more than that, strong, they're strong time trialists, they're rulers, they are quite, they're not little climbers at all. But I don't know, it goes in cycles, does it not?
I don't know whether it goes in cycles. I think it's a sort of progression. The sports become selective. You mentioned basketball there. I mean, there are some notable exceptions, but you can't be 5'7" and play NBA basketball. I mean, you can maybe be sort of 6 foot or 5'11". Swimming, particularly, you know, long limbs, big hands, big feet. These are
long arms.
Long limbs. Yeah, that's what. Yeah.
No, long arms. I mean, short legs and long arms.
Okay, short. Is that right? Short legs, long arms. Okay, well, and certainly big feet, big hands. You know, these are physical attributes that are becoming as key to certain sports as, you know, lung size, you know, a cardiovascular system, which obviously, you know, is not immediately physically evident when you look at someone. So I think cycling is becoming, the sport will select the type of athletes over time, and this trend will become more pronounced. I mean, César mentioned soccer. I think you look at the body types in elite football now compared to even 30 years ago, and it has changed. Midfield players used to be smaller, stockier. Now everybody is 6 foot and a real athlete. And the exceptions, Lionel Messi, for example, you know, they become, they're the outliers in their own particular way. And so I still think it's remarkable that, as you say, Caleb Ewan and Conor Dunn could line up in the same event, despite, you know, being almost probably a foot difference in their height, but they're not going to be good at the same things, are they?
Can I beg to differ and use one of my favorite the cycling podcast words. That is bullshit. Because I'm the old man of the podcast, I'll just name a list of riders: Fausto Coppi, Jack Anquetil, Miguel Indurain, Bradley Wiggins. Tom Dumoulin.
You're using individuals there.
No, what I'm saying, the tour winners have always been the same. Always been the same. They have always been good track riders, good pursuiters, excellent time trial specialists who've lost weight to be able to climb mountains. That's always been the case for the last 60 or 70 years. So, and Tom Dumoulin and Chris Froome are no different in body shape than Fausto Coppi was. Maybe there was the archetype of the Grand Tour winner has been the same for now nearly 60 years. There's a guy, I can't accept that a guy invented a new sport called road cycling or Grand Tour cycling, and this guy was Fausto Coppi, but it was in 1956 or 1952 or 1948. So it's a long time ago. It's more than 60 than 70 years ago. So in my opinion, the archetype of the Tour winner from Coppi to Chris Froome has not changed at all. And I've always heard the same concern that, the true climbers can't win the Tour. Yes, that's right. From time to time, they do. Lucien Van Imp, Federico Bahamontes, Marco Pantani. From time to time, the way the course is done, because there's no time trial in it, or there's more mountain, you've got the climbers winning. It's true with the Vuelta. You've got more mountains in the Vuelta, so it's easier maybe for Quintana to win the Vuelta and to win the Tour. But for me, it's been the case in cycling for many, many years. And about the bulk of sprinters, I mean, can you remember Abdou Japarov, Olaf Ludwig? This guy weighed 120 kilos.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't think, maybe the trend is how could I say, accelerating a little bit, and it's more extreme now. But the patterns have been there for a long time ago.
You do make a good point there. But I think we are seeing more extremes. I think that the riders are skinnier. I mean, I think, you know, that when I think of, you know, Bernardino, Eddie Merckx, you know, these multiple Tour winners or Miguel Indurain, they weren't as skinny as the GC guys are now. So they're getting skinnier.
That's right. Yeah,
that's the trend.
But it applies to the climbers as well. The skinnier aspect goes across the peloton. It's true for climbers. It's true for time trialists, and it's true for sprinters as well.
But because
Mark Cavendish is not a heavy sprinter, nor is Caleb Ewan, nor is you see that these guys are not the Olaf Ludwig type.
It's a really good point that historically. These have all been good time trialists who have effectively turned themselves into guys who can climb and win the Tour. It makes you wonder then why every year when the Tour begins, we do always talk about Romain Bardet as a contender, Nairo Quintana as a contender.
These guys can win the Tour the way Pantani won it once, Lucien Van Imp won it once, Bahamontes won it once, Charlie Gall won it once. It's been like that for a very long time. Climbers have, one day they have that chance. Like Geraint Thomas said, his chance this time is not it, but it's the same kind of body type as the one we mentioned. Or maybe a little bit closer to Eno and Merckx, actually, Gary.
I mean, I can't believe we've waited until the penultimate day of the Tour for the first bullshit.
No, I mean,
it was worth waiting for.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré.
After our grand tour of parts of Great Britain in the spring, we had lots of people asking if we could visit this part of the country or that part of the country, and we're hoping to do that in the late autumn. We're putting together some dates in November now, and we're in a position to announce our Cardiff event, which will be on Tuesday the 27th of November at 7:30. It's at St David's Hall, and if you'd like to buy tickets for that event in South Wales, go to stdavidshallcardiff.co.uk. That's stdavidshallcardiff.co.uk, and you can buy tickets for that event. And a couple of weeks before that, on the 12th of November, we'll be at the Clapham Grand, and we'll be appearing there with Amaratera, the Pizzica band who provide the soundtrack for our Giro d'Italia coverage. That will be us with Amaratera, so it'll be an evening of cycling conversation, humour, if that's your kind of thing, and insight, and the wonderful Amaratera music as well. If you want to buy tickets for that, then go to thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events, or just go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on the tab live events, and you can click on buy tickets. And we hope to see as many people as possible there, and we'll hopefully announce further dates in the coming weeks.